The idea that you can put an entire human body inside an MRI cavity is quite amazing.
What does MRI stand for?
Magnetic resonance imaging. Yes, but we were actually doing it back in the 1960s, but there you could maybe image a bug, but you couldn't image anything bigger than an insect. A finger? Yeah, maybe you could do that. So, in fact, my sons were asking me, Dad, what's the biggest financial goof you ever made in your entire life? And I said, well, I remember back in the 1960s, we were doing physics research on cyclotron oscillators. And so what we discovered was, hey, you know, the cavity where we were investigating the cyclotron oscillation actually generates a lot of heat in a short period of time. And so what we did, and the cavity was maybe 2 inches long by 3/4 of an inch by 3/4 of an inch. But what we did is we got some of these wieners and we cut them up and put the wieners inside the cavity and says, wow, in just 1 minute, you got a cooked hot dog. So this is amazing. And wouldn't it be great if we could actually make the cavity a little bit bigger and you know, we'd have a real oven? Well, that was, what, 1967, so
right.
It's like, you know, we could have patented a microwave oven and all been rich, but we didn't do that. In fact, we had to look over our shoulders because we knew that the professor caught us using the cyclotron oscillator to cook food. He'd be extremely upset. In fact, what we did is before the professor showed up is that we went inside the cabin and very carefully cleaned it so he wouldn't see any grease inside. So, but yeah, I mean, the fact that we could cook something in only a minute, that was pretty amazing.
How expensive did those hot dogs
get? $1 million.
Well, the MRI machine that we were using back then that was like 1 inch by 1 inch by 1 inch, it was $40,000. And that was in 1965 or 66 dollars. So yeah. That's the MRI machine. The cyclotron oscillator wasn't that expensive, but it was still thousands of dollars. So just to have a tiny cavity like that. So, and yeah, I could understand why the professor didn't want us messing it up with hot dog grease, but we did. So, just wanted to share something with you about the amazing time in which we live, because Fuzz Ron and I got to do an outreach event in our studio in Covina, where we were engaging literally skeptics all around the world through video. So it's basically a website, and it's the program is called Putting Christians on the Hot Seat. They got a different title. That's basically what it is. They invite some Christian and they have them sit in front of a camera, and then people all around the world get to put that Christian on the hot seat. Fuzz did it first a week ago, and he says, Hugh, we got to do this again. And so we did. I think it was just this, it was literally Friday afternoon we did it. And but, you know, we could see the person asking the question crystal clear. They could see us crystal clear. And there was a guy moderating it, and he would just switch from, you know, one computer to another. And so there were people in Europe, people in Asia, one guy asking me questions from Perth, Australia. So, I mean, amazing the age in which we live. And of course, all this can be done relatively cheaply. No one has to get on an airplane. But the question that I thought was most interesting was a lady in Europe, and she said, okay, I've read a little bit of the stuff you guys have at Reasons to Believe and understand how it is you use science to establish there must be a God. But it says that simply establishes deism. You know, how do you go from deism to theism and theism to Christianity? I said, you know, that's a really good question. And it's something that's really the heart and center of what Reasons to Believe is all about. And so just reviewed for how it is we can use the beginning of the universe and the space-time theorems to establish there must be a causal agent beyond the universe that creates the universe. But it says, you're right, that's deism. It could be theism, but you've really only established deism. How do you go from there to theism and to Christianity? Well, she says, no, her challenge was this. I know you can do it from the Bible. I want you to do it using only science. Science alone. I mean, So, you know, she was a skeptic and wanted to see how this could be done just through science. And I says, well, we've been working on it, Reasons to Believe, is making the point that if you look at the whole history of the universe, the whole history of Earth, the whole history of life on planet Earth, that every event plays a crucial role in making possible the redemption of billions of human beings. And how every star, every asteroid, every comet, every life form that's ever existed on planet Earth likewise fulfills a role in making redemption possible. Then she jumped in and says, please explain to me what this redemption is. So basically got to lay out the plan of salvation from a biblical worldview perspective. And I said, notice this, of all the different religions of the world, what's unique to Christianity is its message of redemption. That the creator of the universe is someone who wants to redeem humanity from their fallen, sinful state and bring them back into a totally holy and pure moral state. Says, you don't see that in Hinduism, you don't see it in Islam, you don't see it even in Judaism. It's unique to Christianity. And what we're now discovering as we look at the universe, the Earth, and Earth, the history of life on planet Earth, all of it is for the purpose of redemption. And says, this is fantastic. Have you guys ever written a book on this? And so I got to show up to the camera, Improbable Planet. I said, this is our latest book, and that's the theme of the book. And so everything you see in creation is for the purpose of making possible the redemption of billions of human beings. And so the next question is, now where can I buy this book? And, can you give me a review? Yeah, it's like a whole setup. I mean, But also what was interesting is how many other people that were watching or listening, because some people, I mean, they're watching it, others are listening, and how many of them had the same question. You know, how do you Christians go from deism to Jesus Christ? So it's wonderful to have that opportunity. So, and that just led to a bunch more questions. But, yes?
I don't get it.
You don't get it?
No. How would you know about salvation if you didn't know about the Bible? How can you be, I know you can look at the other religions, but then you're looking at their doctrine. So without looking at our doctrine, how can you, I can't get it.
Okay. Well, something else I got to share with this lady and the rest of the audience was this. Okay, notice how everything is for the purpose of redemption. And by the way, when she asked me, what is redemption? I got to lay out the plan of salvation, okay? But again, she says, I want to see it from science alone, not the Bible. I says, well, one other thing you notice about the God of the Bible, it's a triune being. Let me explain to you why science only makes sense if this creator, this deistic person you're referring to is a triune being.
But then you're taking it from the Bible.
No, I'm not. Basically, I was explaining how, okay, what you have in Hinduism is that there's many gods.
Right.
However, and they're all involved in creation. But they're separate in the sense that they all have different creation plans. And so in Hinduism, their view of science is that science will be filled with incongruities, inconsistencies, because after all, there's multiple plans coming from these multiple creators. Whereas in Christianity, you've got a single creator with a single mind and a single plan. However, it's three persons, not one person. And I said, you have religions like Judaism and Islam that says that God is one person and only one person. But they have a problem. The problem is they cannot explain the origin of human beings who experience love and receive love. This is coming from a creator who has had no experience in receiving love or giving love, because after all, love by definition requires at least one other person to be present. And so in one sense, that makes the creation greater than the creator. And does that really make sense? So that's a failing of the strict monotheistic religions. But a failing of Hinduism, they can't explain why the scientific record is so completely consistent and completely harmonious. It really does look like there's a single plan, not multiple plans. And so, and again, the whole audience got to hear this explanation. It's like, wow, you can get the Trinity just by looking at science and science alone. And even got to the point of saying, well, couldn't it work with just two persons and not three persons? said, yeah, it could work with two persons, but now notice when you only have two persons, you get codependency. And codependency does allow love to be expressed and received, but it's not at the high level that you would get if there's no codependency going on. So I said three. So, and again, all from the science. And keep in mind, if you look at the book of Job, and I was able to refer to this, notice that Job lived at a time when there was no scripture. It's the oldest book in the Bible. And yet when you read Job and his debate that he had with his three friends, he lays out the basic redemptive plan, basically pointing out that when we look at nature, we see a God that obviously is very powerful. Because look at everything he's done. Look at the stars, look at the galaxies. I mean, he's a very powerful creator. And you also notice that he's a very providential creator. He provides not only our needs, he provides the needs of every plant and animal species that exists on the face of the earth, and how they're all able to harmoniously serve one another. I mean, for example, the herbivores need the carnivores in order to be have a maximum population to have the greatest quality of life. And so that tells you that the Creator must be a providential and a loving and caring being.
Kind of general revelation.
Right. And so, you know, you read Job, he points out that the Creator must be very powerful, very knowledgeable, and very intelligent, and very loving and caring. And then Job makes the argument. But notice, we all have a law that's been written on our heart, a moral code of behavior. And therefore, he says, this Creator must be a just being, because he's given all of us a law. And the more we try to live up to that law, the more obvious it becomes that the law is there and is universal. But then he also makes the point, notice, none of us can live up to that law. And here's Job, the most righteous man in his generation, and he says, I can't do it. Nobody can do it. But he says this God is so powerful, so intelligent and knowledgeable, and so loving and caring, that there's no way he's going to leave us in a hopeless situation. He must have provided a way out. There must be an advocate. And so you actually see that in the book of Job. He talks about how there's an advocate that makes a bridge between humans and God, and how that advocate is prepared to redeem. And that's why Job was able to say in the 19th chapter, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him in my flesh on the last day. To me, what's impressive about Job, he not only got the basic outline of the gospel right, he was able to express the assurance that he would receive salvation. Because unlike his three friends, he was not counting on his good works. He was counting on the fact that there is a Redeemer that could, you know, advocate for him in front of God and take care of what he was not able to do for himself. So, you know, all that just through looking at the book of nature. God gave us two books. And I think that's the thing that impressed the audience that was the most, was this whole idea. Hey, you Christians actually believe there's two books. The book of nature. Because this group is mainly scientists. In fact, I was told that about 40% of the people who view this thing have PhDs in science or engineering. So, and they love to put Christians on the hot seat. They're just telling me all the ones that didn't do well in the hot seat. I won't give you names. So,
I don't quite understand, and I hope I express this correctly, that say all of nature or the physical world suggests or points towards redemption.
Right.
I don't understand.
Well, I got to explain that again to this audience, making me the point that, as I said, surely you don't need all those stars and galaxies to redeem human beings. And he says, yes, you do. You need the universe to be exactly the size, mass, and age that it is in order to make possible the mere existence of human beings.
Can you define redemption then?
What I mean by redemption is where you've got spiritual beings, intelligent, physical, spiritual beings, that are in an immoral state and are in need, in order to have a relationship with God, to have that immoral state taken care of. And that, you know, the Redeemer is basically God himself trading his moral perfection for moral imperfection. That's what the Redeemer did on the cross. He paid the penalty for all of our imperfections, all of our immorality.
What is it about nature that says that?
What a nature says that?
You have to give a spoiler alert because obviously you're reading your book to us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, buy the book, right? And incidentally, nowhere else in the world can you get the book as cheaply as you can get it here. In fact, my staff keeps complaining, why is reasonsparadoxes.org get such a great deal on the books? So, but that's something you guys negotiated with us, gee, some 30 years ago. So yeah, that's one of the secrets of this class. There's nowhere else where you can get the books as cheaply as right here. So, and you can thank this lady, Colleen here. She's the one that advocates for all of you. So, okay, yes.
I have a friend who asked the same question that Al objected to. He said, when you said how the universe is necessary for us, and that so far, you didn't say so far, but no other galaxy seems to be perfect enough. My friend said, how about a galaxy far, far away? Well, I answered that quickly. Couldn't be far, far away to have enough time. How about a little closer, one that's close enough to not be seen well, but far enough to have billions of years required? Can you address that again a little more?
Yeah, I can. Now, the problem is that galaxies are much more difficult to measure their characteristics than stars because they're far away, they're faint. And even with the largest telescopes, we can only map the detailed features of galaxies that are relatively close. By relatively close, I mean, say, within half a billion light years. Now, that still gets you lots of galaxies. I mean, there's millions of galaxies within that distance range. And there's a paper published, I wrote an article about it on our website, where they looked at 1,400 spiral galaxies. And these are spiral galaxies that come the closest to matching our Milky Way galaxy. And basically examined all of them to see if they had the necessary symmetry of the spiral arms and stability of the spiral structure that they could be candidates for advanced life. And the answer is zero. None of them meet the qualifications. And so the Milky Way remains the only one. Now you could say, well, maybe if you guys looked farther, you'd find one. That's possible. But again, I think you raised a good answer to that. A paper just got published a couple of months ago where they made the point that the minimum time you need that's necessary to have the equivalent of human beings is 13.8 billion years. You can't get advanced life any faster in cosmic history than 13.8 billion years. And basically the theme of the paper was, if you're talking about extraterrestrial intelligent life, we're the first. Maybe they could come after us, but they can't come before us. So if you're looking, you know, say a half billion light years away, you're now looking far enough back in time that it's not a candidate because there just isn't enough time. Maybe enough time for bacteria, but not enough time that's a lot of what's in Improbable Planet, just how aggressive the Creator must act in terms of his interventions to get human beings here as quickly as 13.79 billion years after the cosmic creation event. And actually the book explains why the Creator must get it happening as fast as possible. And it's because of the physics of the sun. It won't be long before the sun is too unstable and it's burning to support human civilization. In fact, what you'll see in the book is that based on the sun alone, we know the time window for human civilization cannot be longer than 100,000 years. And so if the Creator wants the equivalent of human beings, he's got to make it happen at 13.79 billion years after the cosmic creation event. Any earlier you got a problem, any later you got a problem. There's a really, as old as the universe is, there's a very tiny time window in which it's possible. In fact, if you go all the way to the end of the book, I make the point, the time window is no longer than 10,000 years. Now, we're talking civilization, which gets back to your question about redemption. If billions of human beings are to be redeemed in a short period of time, we need technology. And technology requires extreme fine-tuning of the conditions of the Earth. And even with that extreme miraculous intervention, you can't make that window any bigger than about 10,000 years. And so if you want to take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world, you need a certain level of technology. For example, what we experienced Friday afternoon is an example of that technology. Fuzz and I got to engage skeptics all over the world at the same time. That's not possible unless you've got advanced technology. And also, we're able to do it without spending more than a few cents for the electricity, okay? It was done cheaply. Nobody had to get on an airplane. As long as people had computers with reasonably up-to-date software, they were able to engage us. And they were able to engage us as if we were just sitting across the room from one another.
Was that Skype?
It was basically, it was a kind of
business
like, it was business Skype where you could have lots of people come in at once. But I think it was more exotic than that because they were able to take like 100 people that they could participate.
Is it WebEx?
I don't know what the technology was, but we're going to copy it because basically after we were done saying, we need a show like this. This is something that Reasons to Believe needs to be doing. Because we found out from the guy who runs this thing is that he does it for very little investment of resources. So, and then you put it up on YouTube and thousands of people get to watch it afterwards. So it's a great outreach tool. But again, that requires technology. And technology requires that the planet be highly fine-tuned to a far greater degree than what people have ever recognized. I mean, there's 50 books on fine-tuning. But as far as I know, no one's ever addressed the fine-tuning you need for technology. So, and again, that's a powerful argument against the idea that there's these extraterrestrials with advanced civilization. I mean, the amount of fine-tuning you need to make that possible, that it happened once is an outstanding miracle. And so, and you know, the whole point is this God must really care for us a lot when you realize everything he'd done to open up this 10,000-year window. But also, I was encouraged by the announcement of missionaries this morning in our church service, is that we are living at a time when we can actually fulfill the Great Commission quickly. And it's happening all over the world. Okay.
And then they're also talking about Watson, who has this technology from IBM, I think it is, that has the technology to have a lot of information, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea of the amount of data that can be communicated on the internet. I mean, if you were to take us back 50 years and tell people that we'd be able to communicate that amount of data for that little amount of money worldwide, people would say you're crazy. But it's happening. I mean, now, I did read an article. We're fast approaching the limits of the internet. And so the laws of physics eventually are going to limit the amount of communication we can do in the internet. But the fact that we got to the limits of the laws of physics as fast as we did, again, is rather amazing. And actually, I think there's an easy solution. If we can just stop all these teenagers showing video to one another, that will open up a huge amount of space on the internet. But how do you stop teenagers from sharing video clips? So, or maybe what they have to do is put out cell phones that have low def on purpose. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
Everyone is going to see his face. Like from here in America, someone is in England. How is that?
Well, I've heard that within 20 years, virtually every human being will have access to the internet. And the smartphones, already more than half the world's population has a smartphone. And that includes children as well as men and women. So the fact that there's over 3.5 billion cell phones being used by human beings, that's quite amazing. And so maybe Jesus is going to use the internet, maybe he's going to be using smartphones. Or maybe he's just going to have an image appearing all over the world around the planet. I mean, he's got options. So yeah, more than we do. I mean, it actually could be filled with existing technology, but who says that he's going to be limited to our technology? So, But I mean, people ask, what's it going to be like in the millennium? Well, I mean, you know, Jesus will be ruling in downtown Jerusalem, but we'll be able to watch him every night in the nightly news. And, you know, the economy is going to be improved, so everybody's going to have access to it. Or maybe he's going to use another way. I don't know. Yeah. So he's going to text us all. There we go. Okay. Quick segue, and then we're going to segue to the lesson. And how many of you have ever heard of Magellanic Penguins? Magellanic Penguins. Yeah, okay. They're the easiest penguins to study. And so what got published in a journal you probably never heard of, it's called the Auk, A-U-K. I'd never heard of the journal myself. But then somebody says, hey, you got to read this paper. So I read the paper, and it's a paper on a 28-year study of Magellanic penguins. And what they were doing is they were looking at the length of the foot for male and female, and looking at the bill, and looking at the flippers. And the thing about penguins that you probably notice is that when they're on land, they don't move around easily. They also have no fear of humans because, you know, they haven't been abused by humans. And so it's really easy to put tags on these creatures or transmitters or whatever, and they can track them easily. So that's what this group of scientists did. In fact, what's interesting, they're all American scientists. And they went down to the southern tip of Argentina and just began tracking these penguins, thousands of them, over a 28-year period. And what they're really trying to do is put Charles Darwin's theory of the transmutation of species through natural selection to the test. And the point they made is, you know, when Charles Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands, he basically had a few months' worth of data. And, you know, maybe things would be different if you actually look over a long period of time. And so that's what this group did. And what they noticed is for 21 of the 28 years, they detected zero natural selection. They saw variation, but it was variation about the mean. And during the 7 years, this is what they quoted. They said, for 21 of the 28 years, no natural selection. And the 7 years where they did see some natural selection, quote, the direction and intensity of selection on traits varied. In other words, there is no directionality to what they were seeing. Okay, I read that paper and I said, you know, someone else must have done these kinds of studies as well. And I found out that, yes, there was a paper published by four zoologists in Sweden on great reed warblers. I'm not too sure what a great reed warbler is, but I did see a photo of it on Wikipedia, so it gives me an idea. And they also did a multi-decade study of the changes in the morphological features of these birds. And the conclusion was is that they looked at the different populations. The populations, quote, change very little, if anything, over that period of time. So they weren't able to see any directed natural selection. And probably the most dramatic of all is a 30-year-long study of Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands. The very finches that gave rise to Darwin's theory of natural selection, origin of the species. And they said, so they looked at these Darwin's finches over a 30-year period. And here's the conclusion from their paper, that for the different species they looked at, they varied from unidirectional to oscillating to episodic to gradual. And the most common feature they saw was the beaks getting bigger or wider and narrower, wider and narrower in a sinusoidal function. The beaks getting longer and shorter in a sinusoidal way. So it's basically variation about a mean. And then there was another research group that looked at what's called the median ground finch on Santa Cruz. It was one of the largest islands in the Galapagos archipelago. And what's interesting about this median ground finch is that you see two different subgroups of the finch, and so they call it a bimodal species, where you see one mode in one population, another mode in another population. And they said, we want to see how this bimodality changes with respect to time. And what they quote, what they showed after decades is that the natural selection, quote, simultaneously maintains the current bimodality while also constraining further divergence. They saw no divergence, and the bimodality was maintained in a stable function, which basically means that Darwin's theory of the transmutation of species through natural selection doesn't happen. What does happen is you get variation about a mean over long periods of time. Now, before I take any questions, the one weakness of all these studies, all they looked at was birds. But for obvious reasons, birds are the easiest species to study because you know, you can put little tags on them. They fly, so they're easy to find. They don't hide themselves very easily. And so this needs to be followed up with studies on mammals, which has not been done. Let's look at mammals. And the thinking is we're going to actually see less of movement for natural selection with mammals than with birds. But that needs to be put to the test. And then also what you see in the papers is, okay, the longest of these studies was 30 years. What if we were to do a 50-year study? What would we see? Or a 60-year long study? And what if we were to look not only at birds and mammals, but also reptiles and amphibians? And fish would be the most challenging of all. Of course, insects even more so, but that's kind of where the research is going. But it makes the point that it's hard to develop a theory of the evolution of species if you're working with data that only goes past a few months of data collecting. You really need to look at it over years. But also, and the critique these papers have gotten, 30 years is not enough time. After all, life has been here for 3.8 billion years. But the pushback on that is if we're talking birds, 30 years is more than enough time to test the theories, because you can actually see the sinusoidal variations with respect to the climate changes that are going on these different islands. And for what it's worth, there's one study that was done 15 years ago on dandelions. They called them daisies, but dandelion is a daisy. That's what they were doing. So, and they were looking at dandelions on islands off of British Columbia. And what they notice is the bigger the island, the bigger the parachute. So they said, we proved that natural selection actually happens. Well, all they proved is if you got a big island, you're going to get big parachutes. If you got a small island, you're going to get small parachutes. And if you move a dandelion from one island to the other, it will evolve according to the size of the island for obvious reasons. If you've got a small island, you've got big parachutes, the seeds are going to go out into the ocean. They're not going to reproduce. Only the ones with small enough parachutes that they don't blow off the island. And if you've got a big island, well, you're going to want the dandelions to, you know, be able to populate the whole area. You're going to need a bigger parachute, and the bigger parachutes will work. So, but that's, you know, microevolution. And what's interesting is it's just like with these bacteria that are immune to antibiotics.
Drug resistance,
right. It reverts back. And so if you take that dandelion with a big parachute and put it on a small island, it will go to a small parachute. Or take the dandelion with a small parachute, put it on a big island, it'll get a bigger parachute. But it's still a parachute. It doesn't become a dandelion with no parachute at all, or a different way of propagating its seeds. Just like with these drug-resistant bacteria. If you take away the antibiotic, it reverts back to the form it started with. In fact, there's been a lot of talk with disease control centers. What if we could discipline the entire world's population to only use a certain number of antibiotics and then keep the other antibiotics in storage, and you wait for the bacteria to evolve to a point where they're no longer resistant to those bacteria? Then you take the ones that you were using, you put them in storage and bring out the new ones. And you just rotate them over a period of, say, 20 years. That way you always have drugs that will take care of the bacteria. But if you use all the drug antibiotics at the same time, then you wind up with these super bugs that are resistant to everything. And that's the problem we face today. And of course, the big problem is, yeah, it's a great idea. How do we enforce it? You were first.
My argument is that we do have long-term studies on natural selection because of man-made selection. is that balance. So I use horses and dogs always as an example, because the dogs, we figure at least 20,000 years we've been breeding them. Horses, 5 to 10,000 years. We've made the teacup poodles, we've made the Great Danes, we've made the little ponies, we've made these big draft horses, and we've seen that when you go away from the normal, the animal life becomes shorter and his health issues just go out the window. And it just shows that life doesn't want to change. And I pair that also with the junk DNA, where we now see that there's error correction code in the DNA. And so everything that you look at life points that life does not want to change. You can force it to change, but it doesn't want to.
Right.
And so there's no way that you can get a wolf turning into a whale, like they claim. You know, it's just absurd.
Right. Well, that's a good point. And dogs are, of all the mammals we know of, dogs are the ones that are most flexible in terms of microevolution. I mean, you can't do it with cats. With dogs, you can really get, you know, literally hundreds of different breeds. As you mentioned, you can get a Great Dane, you can get a teacup poodle. But in both cases, you've got a dog that's so far bred from the natural origin that it's not very survivable. In fact, my son's girlfriend just had to come back from a trip she made because her Basset Hound died suddenly. And Basset Hounds have been bred to a point where, you know, they're just not, I mean, they got certain characteristics that people really like, but they got short legs and really heavy bodies. And there's a long span in the backbone, and so they're not very survivable. So if you got a dog that's a long ways from a wolf or a fox or a coyote or a dingo, you've got a dog that's not going to live as long. And that requires a lot of human intervention. So for example, you can take one of these vibrating teacup poodles and put it out in the wild. Well, I mean, it's no joke. If you ever seen one of these teacup poodles, they literally vibrate all the time. Put it outside and leave it alone for a few days, and what's going to happen to that teacup poodle? Yeah, it's not going to be able to survive. Likewise, put a Great Dane out in the wild. It's not, you know, it's a big dog, but it's not going to be able to survive. It just doesn't have the mobility. Yes?
Two things. One, I assume, playing devil's advocate, if I were told about these studies about how any evolutionary changes are merely micro changes that are plus or minus around a mean, and they don't go anywhere, that as, let's say, an atheist, I would, if I were an atheist, I'd say 30 years is not enough.
Right, and that's exactly the pushback. So people are saying, well, let's do a 50-year study.
Okay. That's my point, was look at horses and dogs. You can't argue that we have thousands of years there.
But
that's a good point.
It's not birds. It is long enough. So that's my first question. You explained that. You said with birds, it is long enough. Two, haven't we done that with bacteria with billions of generations?
Well, okay. 20 years of bacterial evolution study in a lab is equivalent to 1 million years of human evolution. And so, yeah, people have done. In fact, there's one study that's been done at Michigan State. They've looked at E. coli bacteria for 30 years. Or they're forcing through lab laboratory controls as much evolution as possible. And it's basically like with the dogs. They're showing that, yes, you can get microevolution, but it's got hard limits. You can't take it past a certain barrier. You're not going to make a dog smaller than a teacup poodle. And you're not going to come up with a dog bigger than a Great Dane. We've hit the limits. And they're still dogs. They haven't become a different species. Okay. But what you also notice with birds is that there were 22,000 species of birds when God created Adam and Eve. There's now 10,800. Over half of them are gone. How many new ones have we seen show up? Well, it depends on your definition. And this is where you've got to be careful in reading the scientific literature, because you'll find lots of papers where they say, we've seen a new species of birds evolve. But the problem you're dealing with is their definition of a species. You know, Fuzz wrote an article where he said there are 16 different definitions of a species in the scientific literature. And we had a gal from South Africa come and visit us as a visiting scholar. And she says, Fuzz, you're way too conservative. There's way more than 20 different definitions of a species you see in the scientific literature. And so one way that they claim we've seen a new species of birds, it's one species of birds where some of the birds fly over a mountain range. And then they get over that mountain range and they begin to experience microevolution, and if you put birds from that population back together with birds on the other side of the mountain, they won't mate with one another. They prefer to just mate with the birds of their own little subgroup. And so people say, well, one definition of a species, that speciation event, where there's no longer the possibility of a breeding to take place. And they said, well, this proves that a species occurred. But here's the rebuttal to that. Is it reversible? In other words, could we actually take some of the birds that are on one side of the mountain range, put them on the other side, let them mix with the population of birds there, and see if over time they really will mate with members? And those experiments have been done. It is reversible. I mean, another good example is they said, well, you know, it's in the literature, there's never been observed a single speciation event of mammals. Well, one group paper said, aha, the buffalo that existed here in North America are now two species. You got the plains buffalo and the wood buffalo. And hey, if you go on the internet, you'll still see that that's being talked about today, how we got two different species of buffalo. But the latest research is that that was a mistake. We don't have two species of buffalo, we got one. The problem is we gathered up the few remaining buffalo at the end of the great buffalo hunt of the 19th century, and a bunch of them were put in a national park up by the 60th parallel in Canada. In fact, it's the largest national park in the world. It's called Wood Buffalo National Park. It's basically a preserve for these buffalo. The rest of the buffalo they gathered up and they put in Colorado. There's some on Catalina Island, so those are the plains buffalo. Well, notice, one population of these buffalo was put in an area where it's really cold, and another place where it's much warmer. And what they notice is the wood buffalo are bigger than the plains buffalo, and therefore they said it's a separate species. Well, for obvious reasons. If the buffalo are living in a really cold place where it's cold for a long period of time, the buffalo that are most likely to survive are those of the largest body sizes, because they can maintain internal body heat better than the ones that are small. So that explained the size difference. But then they brought the two populations of buffalo together and they found that they bred just fine. So now they've corrected all the classifications, says, no, we only have one species of buffalo, so not two.
Why are birds, for 30 years regarding the birds, why is that an adequate?
Well, it's adequate because we can actually see the sinusoidal variation about the mean. And so it's basically showing you that the data, it's possible that if you get a climatic change as unidirectional, you'll get an evolutionary change as unidirectional. However, it's going to have hard limits. And again, the idea with the horses, the cows, the chickens, the dogs that we've hyperbred, there are limits. So the combination of the sinusoidal nature of the microevolution plus the evidence that we have that there's hard limits to where you can go. And again, there's been what they're called conservation biology studies that show that if you look at a population of a species where the numbers are declining, that species heads inexorably to extinction unless humans intervene. So once a population drops below a certain size, they tend to go extinct unless we intervene. But I think I mentioned here a year ago, there were three papers published on mammals saying that the adult body size of the mammal is greater than 3 kilograms. That's 7 pounds for those of you who don't like the metric system. If the animal's adult body size is bigger than 7 pounds and we humans don't intervene, it will go extinct before it can evolve in any significant way. Extinction always happens more rapidly than evolution. And so if you've got a mammal bigger than 7 pounds, I argue that the limit is way below 7 pounds. But field observations have definitively established if it's bigger than 7 pounds, for sure it's going to go extinct before it evolves. Now, I suspect you're going to get the same results for mice and rats, but those studies haven't been done. There you need a longer time.
And and the bacteria, lastly. So how many billions of years have we been able to project out studies?
Okay, the longest study on the evolution of bacteria is 30 years long.
Which is?
And that's equivalent to more than a million years of bipedal primate evolution. Yeah.
And have any new species of bacteria come along?
No, it's still E. coli bacteria. And matter of fact, you could argue that the experiment is not a fair experiment, but it does tell you what the limits are from a very conservative perspective, because what they did is they took a dozen different populations of E. coli bacteria. So there were separate populations, and they grew them in a laboratory where they starved the bacteria of sucrose, which is its normal diet. And instead, they fed it a huge abundance of citrate, knowing ahead of time that the E. coli bacteria had the biochemical machinery inside the cell to metabolize both citrate and sucrose. And so the goal was to evolve these E. coli bacteria from feeding on sucrose to feeding on citrate. The other thing they knew ahead of time was this. What's stopping the E. coli bacteria from feeding on citrate are the pores in the membrane of the citrate, that they were designed to let sucrose come through, but not citrate. But they also knew that if they had three mutations in the pore structure of that E. coli bacteria, it would be able to take in citrate. So they knew ahead of time which mutations they needed. They had these dozen populations, and they fed them a starvation diet of sucrose and all the citrate they wanted, something that would never happen in the natural realm, and they waited to see what would happen. And the goal of the experiment is they knew that they were going to get the result. Because of bacteria, it was simply inevitable that one of them would get the necessary mutations. It was a shock for them how long they had to wait. It was over 20,000 generations before they found a population that actually did the deed. But the real goal is to say, how much longer do we have to wait for the other populations to do it as well? To this day, it's still only one population. Basically showing evolution doesn't repeat. And that was the goal of the experiment. A lot of people think the goal of the experiment was to prove whether evolution happens. They said, no, at this level, we know it's going to happen. Our goal is to see if it repeats. Because there's two competing theories, one that says it does repeat and one that says it doesn't. And we've written about this in our book, More Than a Theory, where we basically say it's the death knell to the Darwinian evolutionary model, the fact that they can't get it to repeat. Why? Because in the natural realm, we see repeated design events everywhere with species that are unrelated from an evolutionary perspective. And so for that to be true, we'd have to be able to see it happening in the lab, and it's not happening in the lab. So it basically says there's something fundamentally wrong with a Darwinian evolutionary paradigm.
Repeat, you mean a second generation of different changes, right?
Well, to be careful on this, what they did do is they found one population where they got it feeding on citrate. And so what was elegant about the experiment, every 500 generations, they put a subset of that population in suspended animation, basically cold storage. They stopped it from doing anything. And so after 21,000 generations, they got the result they're looking for. They went back to 20,000 generations, pulled out this thing out of cold storage, and said, can we get that to repeat? And it did. But if they went back more than 5,000 generations, nothing happened. And so it settled the debate between Stephen Jay Gould and Simon Conway Morris. Gould basically saying evolution will be random. You're not going to get repeated outcomes. Simon Conway Morris says, based on all the examples of repeated outcomes, it must repeat. And so the debate basically said Gould got it right. Simon Conway Morris got it wrong. But Simon Conway Morris got it right where he said, look at these thousands of examples we see in nature. Something must be happening to explain the repeated outcomes. And Simon Conway Morris is a theist, and his whole point is God's got to be involved somewhere. Yes?
Where in Darwin's tree do insects come in? I mean, I've always I never thought about it. Maybe it's a stupid question. I mean, we always think the fish came out, according to him, and became this, and flew away, and whatever. But where did insects come from and develop in his model?
Well, they're part of his model, and his model basically is you start off with a single bacterial-type life form, and you know it evolves and becomes more and more complex and splits off, and you get this phylogenetic tree. But what these new studies are basically showing us is the phylogenetic trees don't fit the data that we're looking at. And that was Simon Conley Morris's argument. He says, you got fish and you got reptiles, one living in the desert, one living in the bottom of the sea, and they got the identical design features. And yet they're not related in any kind of Darwinian phylogenetic tree. How do you explain the fact they got the identical design features?
But if the thing came out of the ocean and did this, where did these bacteria come from? I mean, where is he saying they, I mean, not bacteria, the insects, like what were they to begin with? Just bacteria?
No, he would have put the insects back at the Cambrian explosion era and afterwards. And so you go from bacteria to animals. However, it was Darwin himself who admitted that the Cambrian explosion was the biggest challenge to his model. Because he says, you know, you go from microbes to animals that are as big as 2 meters across, and it happens with no time gap. So it says that's quite a stretch to go from microbes to creatures that are 2 meters across without any time passage.
So you could never use that. You better never bring that up to Cambrian.
Well, I mean, you do have a number of evolutionary biologists who say where Darwin got it wrong, he thought it was a gradual process. And that was Darwin's idea, that it was a natural process and it takes a lot of time and it's small steps. And you've got people like Stephen Jay Gould making the point that, hey, the fossil record shows that doesn't happen. You've got these quantum jumps. And so his model, again, was that when a population declines to a small population, small enough that it doesn't leave any fossil remains, that's when it rapidly evolves.
How?
He said, well, it just does.
That was his big problem.
That's the problem. It's a just-so story.
Right.
And it's challenged by conservation biology studies. And it's interesting, I've debated evolutionary biologists where they're very dismissive of conservation biology. They said, that literature doesn't count. I said, what do you mean it doesn't count? The core of your model is that when a population of a species drops to a very low level and becomes stressed by its environment, it's going to rapidly evolve into a completely different species. But we got field experiments that can put that to the test. We actually can observe a species that drops to a small population, experiences extreme environmental stress, and what happens to it? It doesn't evolve, it goes extinct. Right. And if we intervene to save the species, what kind of species do we get? The same species we started out with. So that's why we've been arguing you can't isolate conservation biology from evolutionary biology. The two disciplines must be integrated. But there's great resistance in the biological community for integrating those two disciplines. And that's not isolated. One of the struggles we face at Reasons to Believe is getting scientists to integrate across the scientific disciplines. I see a similar problem with Christians, getting Christians to integrate across the 66 books of the Bible. I think God gave us 66 books for that very reason. He wants us to integrate them. He gave us different scientific disciplines for the same reason.
You mean the answers aren't all in Genesis?
The answers are not all in Genesis, and the answers aren't all in genetics. So, I mean, it's interesting when I've been debating biologists, they'll say, you know what, I freely admit that there are serious anomalies in my subdiscipline, but all the other biological sciences have got it worked out. I says, no, you need to go talk to them. Every one of them admits that they got big anomalies. If you simply integrate across the biological disciplines, you'll see it's ubiquitous. And if it's ubiquitous, something's wrong with the model. Yes?
A lot of these studies, I mean, I guess they're carried out to either confirm, I can't imagine that they're undertaking a study to disprove Darwin's theory, or Darwin's theory. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that they're going to getting any support to do that. So they're getting support from somewhere to gather data to further support Darwin's evolutionary theories.
Now, what was
that's what seems to be going on.
Now, what's really going on at Michigan State is that they were testing two competing sub-Darwinian models. And so one model that they were testing was this model that, hey, you're going to get random outcomes from evolution. It's not going to repeat. Then you had this guy from Britain, Sinway Conway Morris, saying, it's got to repeat because we see repetitions everywhere. So they were trying to test those two models against one another. But they're both considered evolutionary models. Sinway Conway Morris is a theist, but he's a theistic evolutionist. So he believes that God works in some hidden way behind the natural process. So those are the two models they were putting to the test. Likewise, you've got people in South Africa who are still holding on to the Darwinian principle. It's all gradual process. There are no quantum jumps. Whereas you've got people in America and Europe saying there have to be quantum jumps because that's what the fossil record reveals. And so those two schools. So yeah, within the Darwinian paradigm, you've got a lot of sub-models that are competing with one another, and you can get funding to test one Darwinian model against another Darwinian model.
You can.
You can, yeah, and that's what's happening. But we think it's great because the evidence is showing problems with all the models. So, and that wouldn't have happened unless there was funding given to. And to me, it's remarkable that our federal government was willing to give a research team at Michigan State a lot of money to do this experiment on bacteria where they knew nothing significant was going to come out of the results for 20 years. Our government is not noted for funding long-term research projects. However, there was a fellow by the name of Lenski at Michigan State who said, this has got to be done. And he was young enough, and he had enough graduate students with him. They said, okay, we're going to give you the money. And it wasn't all that expensive. So they got the money to do it.
Where does that come out of? NASA?
Usually the National Science Foundation. With NASA, it's harder to get them to fund long-term research projects, but NSF will do it if it's not too expensive. And if you're going to get a significant breakthrough result, and that's what they've said, you know, we're going to be able to prove one of these models wrong, at least one, if not both. And NSF said, hey, go for it. And we're willing to wait 20 years. And they got some initial results after. It took 21 years before they could publish anything significant. But now they've published 4 papers. And the experiment is now in the 30th year.
Different PI and everything else.
No, it's the same principal investigator. Lemsky's still running the program after 30 years. In fact, I argue that's a powerful motivation for scientists to live a healthy life so that they can finish their research project. The most extreme example I remember that was an astronomer who was in his mid-20s who undertook a research project he knew it would take 70 years before he got results. But he lived a healthy lifestyle, and he was able to, in his 90s, to publish the results. So, okay. So, if you want motivation to live a healthy life, go into research science. All right. Yes.
Well, since we understand the mechanics of genetics, and we understand the numbers involved, the numbers, genes, and so on, and I understand people have undertaken, you know, trying to write algorithms for how the process marches forward, what results will come out as you go, that what that math has shown in biology, and it's kind of hard to mix math with biology, but I understand people have tried, that the math running the computer model for random mutation and natural selection, that you don't get any results unless you put arbitrary constraints into it. In other words, draw pre-conclusions for the math to arrive somewhere, almost like, I guess, analogous to Einstein's cosmological constant. In order to make the results come out, you have to put an arbitrary constraint in. In other words, you have to design what you want to get.
Well, part of what's happening at Reasons to Believe is that we're involved in a two views book with an organization that basically is using mathematical models of genetics to try to prove a natural evolutionary trajectory for life. And, you know, our critique is, yeah, it's great mathematics, but it assumes an evolutionary paradigm to begin with. It's model dependent. And so if you don't assume the model, you get completely different results. Her other critique is, yeah, you're throwing in data, and you've got some idea of the random error bars, but you have no idea of the systematic error bars. And you know, I find this is pretty common in biology, is that they really are not in a position to deal with systematic errors. And for good reason. They're dealing with a subject matter that's extremely complex. And so there may be multiple factors that are generating the results that we have no idea what they are. And I would say, that's fine. Go ahead and do the research, but please don't be so dogmatic in your publication saying this is the way it is and it's the only way it can be. If you have no idea what the systematic effects are, then... In fact, I put an article on our website basically trying to communicate to lay people the difference between random errors and systematic errors. All of you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. We move on. All right. Anyway,
for our lesson?
No, it's not time to pray.
Okay.
Tell us what he's going to do next time he teaches.
Yes. All right. I left you a homework assignment last week, and so now you got an extra week to get it done. All right?
2 weeks.
2 weeks, yes, because I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going to be in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee for a while. Okay. So, but it's chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes. And I think the best way to understand chapter 6 is put it in the context of what you see in the first three verses of Ecclesiastes. How does that start off? Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. In chapter 6, it talks about things that we think have meaning, and Solomon basically says, you're kidding yourself, they don't. This is not where meaning lies. And it's a great chapter on the philosophy of existentialism. And so what I'm asking you to do is go through chapter 6 and see if you can pick out the foundations of existential worldview thought. What is existentialism? We exist. There is no God. There is no meaning or purpose in life. But we do the best that we can, in spite of the fact we know there's no purpose or meaning in our life. So pick out that teaching out of chapter 6. And as you go through chapter 6, you're going to notice a habit that Solomon can never avoid. Whatever he writes in the Bible, he throws in Proverbs. So whether you're looking at the book of Proverbs or Ecclesiastes or looking at the Song of Solomon, you keep finding these little pithy Proverbs in there. See if you can pick them out of chapter 6. Chapter 6 is the shortest chapter in the book, so there's not a whole lot to study there. But then he subtly makes the point, okay, yes, everything looks meaningless, but we know down deep there is meaning. How do you find meaning when everything looks meaningless? See if you can dig that part out. And then the point he makes is, when you do find meaning, don't get so concerned about the meaning and purpose in your life, you forget to have fun. You forget to experience joy. And if you're really fulfilling God's purpose in your life, you're going to have joy in the midst of your suffering. And that's something you also see in there, is that, yeah, we all suffer. And if you go to the New Testament, when you really do find purpose and meaning in your life, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer more. You say, well, why should I even bother if I'm going to suffer more? Because, as James and Paul and Peter point out, when you really find meaning in your life and you pursue that meaning and fulfill the destiny that God has for you, you will suffer, but you're going to be happy and joyful in your suffering. So that's the final question. How can you be joyful and happy in the suffering you experience through discovering and fulfilling your purpose and destiny in life? And hey, you see that abundantly in the New Testament epistles. Peter, James, Paul, Barnabas, they all were joyful and happy and excited about the suffering they were experiencing. They could count it all joy. So look at James chapter 1, look at 2 Peter 4, and see if we can emulate that style. And how do you make that work in your life? So that's what we're going to do 2 weeks from today. All right, you've got 2 weeks to study chapter 6. But the tip is, put it in the context of the first three verses of Ecclesiastes 1. With that, I'll bow for prayer. Father in heaven, We thank you that these books that Solomon wrote are so subtle, so deep, and so meaningful and fulfilling. And help us, Lord, as we go through this chapter 6, to see how Solomon is trying to get us depressed first in order that we can find ultimate hope, purpose, and destiny. And Father, I pray you would help us in our witnessing to be able to use those, that two-edged sword, how we can help people to get more impressed or depressed, and in that depression, actually find true joy and peace and fulfillment. In Jesus' name, amen.